From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, now that Milwaukee has won the bid to host the 2020 Democratic National Convention, what comes next?
Some of the biggest challenges are getting people over the preconceived notions about what Milwaukee can handle and what it can do, and trying to get people on board with something, I think, this ambitious.
Then we learn about the Ward Irish Music Archives that are not in Ireland, but in Wauwatosa.
Plus, we'll listen back to a music performance with Ireland's Shaolin. Most of the Irish band met in an Irish language camp and had no idea that they'd quickly become a force in both Irish and pop music.
You should have seen our first practice. We all showed up and were like, oh, let's make a band. This is going to work. So Kevin showed up with his accordion, and the rest of the six of us at the time showed up with acoustic guitars. Six guitars and an accordion.
Lake Effect Weekend is next. After the news.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It's official. On Monday, the Democratic National Committee chose Milwaukee as the site of its 2020 convention. Houston and Miami were the other finalists. According to DNC Chair Tom Perez, this is the first time the Democratic Party has held a national convention in the Midwest outside of Chicago since 1916.
Milwaukee's success in winning the host bid is due in large part to the efforts of members of the bid committee, which included Mayor Tom Barrett, Governor Tony Evers, Congresswoman Gwen Moore, and our next guest, Milwaukee Bucks Senior Vice President and bid chair, Alex Lazary. Alex, it's a pleasure to have you on Lake Effect, and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You have been working on this for a long time. So why was it so important to you to get the convention here?
Well, you know, besides my Democratic leanings, for me, the most important thing about this was trying to put Milwaukee on the map in a way that it hadn't been before. You know, some of that thought process came from watching the Amazon HQ2 process play out. And whether you think Amazon should have come here or anything like that, to me, was irrelevant. It was more about the fact that we weren't even in the conversation. That, to me, is a problem, because Milwaukee is this great city, and it is a vibrant city, and it's a growing city. And I want people to see Milwaukee and love Milwaukee in the same way that I do. And so when Milwaukee wasn't even in the conversation, you never even saw the star in the map with Milwaukee on it, I thought that it was mostly just because people didn't know much about Milwaukee. And, you know, you then see these articles coming out about Milwaukee being this best-kept secret. And so I think what I wanted to do was out Milwaukee and bring Milwaukee to the national attention and start making sure that people realize that we're a city that should, you know, be considered the next Austin or the next Denver, and be in, you know, that tier of cities with the Miamis and Houstons of the world.
What were the challenges you found when you tried to do that, when you started working on this bid? How long ago? 18 months ago?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some of the biggest challenges are getting people over the preconceived notions about what Milwaukee can handle and what it can do, and trying to get people on board with something, I think, this ambitious and this big. It's a lot, and it's a lot to handle, and it's not something that we've typically gone after. But the biggest problem wasn't locally. It was nationally. It was getting the people around the country, and especially at the DNC, to understand and realize that Milwaukee isn't this small Rust Belt city, that we are a growing, vibrant 21st century city that can handle something like this. And if the DNC or any political convention wants to be able to do something outside of five cities, you need to start taking cities like Milwaukee more seriously. And getting people over that hump and over those preconceived notions that we can't raise money, that we don't have enough hotels, that we don't have the venue spaces, was a lot more challenging than I thought. But clearly, we were able to get there.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do you think turned the tide? Was it FISERV?
FISERV definitely had a lot to do with it. I think what turned the tide was our site visit. You know, we were able to run a really flawless and execute, I think, one of the strongest site visits that has happened. And we were able to show Milwaukee at its best, and show that we were also a team that could handle something of this magnitude. And, you know, Fiserv Forum as like the crown jewel of the pitch certainly helped. I mean, it was the second day that the arena had been opened, so you still had that new car smell on it. But also being able to show the convention center and the venues, you know, Miller High Life Theater and Panther Arena as other possible venues, being able to show all the land around Fiserv Forum and what type of flexibility and ability to reimagine what a convention could look like, showing them actually the hotel rooms and being like, hey, when we say 20 minutes away, we mean 20 minutes away. And I've lived in East Coast cities before. When we say 10 minutes away, it's 30 minutes. And that's not here. When we say 20, it's 20. And so I think that was something that they had to realize. I think the other thing was seeing the depth and breadth of the support from the community. We did an event at Northwestern Mutual where we had over 200 business leaders and community leaders show up and talk to DNC members and say how important this would be to the city and how much it would mean to them to come here. And I think when you show them all of that, it, I think, took us from a fringe finalist as like, hey, we need to put Milwaukee in the finalist, and turned us into, I think, an actual contender and the eventual winner.
Well, we're looking at, I've seen numbers ranging from $200 to $300 million dollars in economic impact from the convention and its ancillary and related events. How much of that do you feel is going to come back directly into the community?
I think almost all of it, and probably all of it. You know, what you end up seeing is this is not going to be something that's just going to benefit the hotels and restaurants. This is something that's going to benefit the entire city. We're going to need 12,000 volunteers. We're going to need a ton of small businesses from Milwaukee to put on not just the events that happen in the arena. You know, that's the main event, what goes on in there. But there are 1,500 events that are going to happen all across the city in venues all across the city and maybe even probably a little bit outside the city. So we're going to need businesses to help put those on. We need catering, AV, you know, different vendors, transportation. You name it, we need a business like that to put on this entire convention. And our hope is that the vendors that are doing this are going to be people that look like Milwaukee and that are Milwaukee. And we want this convention to be stamped made in Wisconsin. And so, you know, I think all of the money and economic impact that is going to happen is going to reverberate not just in downtown, but across the whole city. And that's just the immediate impact. That doesn't even take into consideration the future business and exposure that you get from hosting something like this. I mean, this is something that will reverberate for 5 to 10 years. And a perfect example of that is Denver. Denver wasn't what we think of Denver now when it hosted before, until it hosted the convention in 2008. And that's not to say that by hosting this convention, we're automatically going to take that leap, but it's that first step. And it's what will set the tone for what we do after that. And we need to make sure that we don't let this opportunity go by, because it'll be great to host the convention, but then what are we doing in year 2, 3, and 4? How are we capitalizing on this moment that we have? And we need to make sure that we're staying just as ambitious and dreaming just as big post-convention that we were in this 2 years leading up to it.
You talked about having it look like Milwaukee. And of course, one of the things about Milwaukee is that it is one of the most segregated cities in America. I know the DNC will probably be talking about that politically, but economically, are you hoping to award contracts to minority-owned and women-owned businesses to help shape that view of who we are?
That is a top priority of the host committee and the DNC. You know, this was something that I've done with Fiserv Forum, where we made sure that we had a goal of 25% of services being awarded to minority owned businesses. And we ended up doing over 30%. And we want to make sure that we're exceeding those goals for the convention. And I think we will. You know, Martha Love and Jason Ray have been leading our efforts on that, where they did about 5 town halls and events around the city, where they asked people to go to Milwaukee2020.com and register your business with the host committee. So that will allow us to know when people are trying to book events at different venues, which vendors we can send them to. And so we are going to make sure that we put an emphasis on minority-owned, women-owned, LGBTQ, veterans, disabled businesses so that, again, everyone is benefiting. This convention is only going to be successful if everyone benefits. And, you know, again, we need to make sure this isn't the silver bullet for everything. You know, just similar with the arena, that's not going to be the silver bullet to solve some of the issues that Milwaukee has. And I think it's important that we talk about them. But I think what this will do is be the jumping off point for Milwaukee taking that next step and growing into a top tier city.
You talked a little bit earlier about the logistics, you know, needing hotel rooms and getting people to and from places. We have a very definite timeline now. It's about 18 months away before this happens. What kinds of things is the committee doing right now to start making sure all of that runs smoothly in July next year?
So, you know, I look at these next 3 to 4 months as the planning stages. So this is where we really start to dive into what this behemoth looks like and what we need to do. And that's going to be working in concert with the DNC, who has done this 100 times or something like that. And so looking at how they do that, making sure that they understand what it's like on the ground here, because we have the local expertise, and working with them on making sure that transportation is not an issue. Because yes, some of our hotels are a little bit, you know, further outside the city, and we need to make sure that we have good bus checkpoints, that we have good pickup and drop-offs, and that all the information is easy and clear and readily available. And so those are all things that, you know, we'll be working on, thinking about those things over the next 3 to 4 months, and then implementing them over, you know, probably the 10 to 12 months after that. But the most immediate step right now is trying to, you know, get as many people signed up, again, on Milwaukee2020.com, as volunteers. We're going to need 12,000. And that's a significant amount of people that we need involved in participating. And so it's going to take a big effort from, you know, not just the business community, but from the local community as well, because 12,000 volunteers is nothing to sneeze at. But
just coordinating that number of people.
Yep, just coordinating that many people and all the delegates that are going to be coming in, because you've got 12,000 volunteers and then 50,000 people who are descending upon the city. And so it's a lot. And I don't know if everyone quite realizes what this is yet. But what I think is exciting is the possibilities of how much the community can participate in something like this. And so I think, you know, the possibilities are really endless.
Well, I think some people do realize, because, you know, the inevitable complaining on social media has started probably from the minute announcement was
on
made.
On social media?
I know. Nobody complains there. But I'm already hearing, well, where am I going to park? How am I going to get to work? You know, I think I'm going to leave town. How do you work to get the doubters on board, because you're going to have some?
Yeah, and I think it's just about being open, honest, and transparent. I think you have to discuss what this is going to be. And that's going to be doing as many community events as we can. You know, I want to get around and speak to as many groups and as many people as possible to be honest about what this is. I can honestly say this is going to be, to locals, there's a chance that this is an inconvenience to some people. And not a chance. This will be an inconvenience to some people. But that's sometimes the price we have to pay for something this big and for something this important. It's no different than if we get an NBA Finals. Traffic becomes a little bit more intense. Security becomes a little bit more intense. But you deal with that inconvenience because it's something that's important and that's big and that will lead to future growth and future opportunities. So I think as long as you're honest and transparent about what some of the inconveniences will be, and let people plan around that and say, hey, if this is going to be too much for you, then let's figure something out. If, you know, you're worried about, you know, parking or getting to your job, okay, we need to then work on that and figure out how can we make this work for everyone, not just the delegates and the 50,000 people who are coming in, but also for the people who live in the city. And you know, I think a great way to do that is volunteering and being a part of the action. If you've got a small business, making sure that you're registered so that we can make sure that you're benefiting financially from it. But then otherwise, it's just trying to work with everyone to say, okay, what can we do? And then being honest about, like, hey, this is something we can't do. It's going to suck for 3 days, and then everything's going to be better.
The Wisconsin GOP has made their disdain for Milwaukee very, very clear. Are you worried about that at all, that there will be blowback from the GOP that will somehow put a damper on what happens here next year?
No, I don't think so. What I've been pleasantly surprised about is the bipartisan support for this convention. You know, former Governor Walker signaled his support not only yesterday, but also when he was governor, about how big he thinks this is for the city. You're seeing business leaders who are Republican who are also saying how important this is. The money coming in here is green. It's not red or blue. At any convention, are you going to have political convention? Are you going to probably have members of the other party, doing some sort of protest or something like that? Sure. But I think that's priced into bringing a convention to the city. And that's also part of being a swing state. That's just something that's going to happen. But from terms of support, you know, I haven't really spoken to many people who have said that this isn't something that they think is big. You know, when I see my Facebook and I've got friends who are Democrats and Republicans, a lot of what I see is, regardless of your political affiliation, this is something that's big for the city and the state. And I think that's what's important. This convention, it's bigger than politics. For the city and state, this is about reintroducing ourselves to the international stage and how do we take advantage of that moment.
Are you worried at all that we can't live up to that as a community?
No, because I think we already are living up to it. Now it's just about everyone seeing that. And it's about everyone witnessing it and feeling it. You know, one of the reasons that I feel so confident about this is just the last 3 or 4 years, whenever I have friends from the East Coast or West Coast come to visit, they immediately want to come back. And I think that says something about what this city does to people and the hold that it can grab on people. It's fun. You know, these conventions are, you know, at the end of the day, they're one big party and, you know, no one throws a party like Milwaukee. And I think that's what makes this city special, is that when people come here, they don't want to leave. And if they, you know, have to go back, they want to come back. So I'm not worried that Milwaukee can't live up to it, because as long as we're being who we are, we're already living that every day. It's now just about time that the world sees it and starts to participate in it.
Alex Lazary is the Milwaukee Bucks senior vice president and the bid chair for the committee that secured the 2020 Democratic National Convention for the city. There is more information about the convention and how to register your business or volunteer at WUWM.com.
Coming up, we revisit our Lake Effect on-site event in East Tosa, which featured guests from the Ward Irish Music Archives, just in time for St. Patrick's Day. Lake Effect Weekend returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
Back with more of Lake Effect Weekend, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The Ward Irish Music Archives in Wauwatosa is dedicated to preserving Irish and Irish-American music, and it's one of the educational arms of the Milwaukee Irish Fest. The collection has more than 50,000 pieces, which includes, among many other items, recordings, songbooks, and sheet music.
Barry Stapleton is the director of the Ward Irish Music Archives, and Jeff Kasich is the archivist. They both joined us on stage at Birch on North Avenue in East Tosa for our on-site event last month. Stapleton starts by explaining how an archive of Irish music came to be established in a Midwestern city. He said it all began with the founder of Irish Fest.
It actually happened in Ireland when Ed Ward was looking for talent in Ireland to play the festival. The Irish Traditional Music Archives in Dublin had just opened up, and Ed thought he'd stop in and see what they were doing. And he was waiting in a little room in a library, and Ed went to pick out a book, and he actually picked out a book that was written by his grandfather. And so that was his inspirational moment, and he came back and asked the board, if they're doing that in Ireland, who's doing that in America? He asked the board of Irish Fest to support the archives, the Ward Irish Music Archives, and that was the beginning, 1992.
So where did the first items come from?
Well, with the success of the festival in the early years, especially in the 80s, we were growing rapidly, and at that time, it was pre-CDs, so we were getting PR kits from bands, and at one point, we were getting 500 PR kits a year. just from the success of the festival. So that core collection is still our core collection. It grows every year. Although the difference now, instead of a LP, I get an email from a band saying, we're the best Irish band ever. Check out our website. And so now it's more of a digital collection versus the hard copy.
Who are the archives here for? Who uses them?
The archives are kind of here for the public in general that has any kind of interest in Irish or Celtic-related music. So we've had student groups come in to take a tour to kind of take a look at the material. We also have Irish musicians that will do research. And actually, we have some kind of genealogical ties where people know that their families has Irish musicians or some sort of Irish music tie in their family, and they'll reach out to us, and we'll see how we can help them.
There's also a lot of historical stuff that's come up from Chicago. I know you have wax cylinders, so things that go back 100 years or more.
Yeah, absolutely. We have the Dunn Family Collection, which has within it 32 wax cylinder recordings, recorded by Francis O'Neill of Chicago, who's a brilliant Irish music collector, rose to be captain of the police department down in Chicago in the early 1900s. And they're field recordings of traditional musicians from Chicago. And they came up to an Irish musician that emigrated to Milwaukee in the 1870s named Michael J. Dunn. And he kept that material after some of the musicians in Chicago had passed away. And they stayed in an attic in South Milwaukee for 80 years. And the family found them one day as they're clearing out the house looking for their grandfather's firefighter uniform. Michael J. Dunn was a firefighter on the Milwaukee firefighter force, and brought them to the archives. And the rest is history. We worked with the Library of Congress to digitize those cylinders and then made them available on a website and also a CD project.
So you can hear them if you go to the website.
Yeah.
You can actually hear those.
You can go to wardirishmusicarchives.com and listen to all those cylinders.
Well, and so talk about your work as an archivist. What goes on in a typical day at the archives, and what does your work involve?
Those of us in the archives profession have a favorite phrase, which is, it depends. Depends on the day. But mostly, I've been working on a lot of cataloging, so it's kind of almost a traditional library role, but we also work on digitization projects, digitizing sound recordings and video recordings. We've worked on a couple of major digital collections like the Irish Sheet Music Archives, where we've made public domain sheet music available as well. So it's a lot of working with analog recordings and moving into the digital domain.
So you talk about sheet music. Do you lend things out? Is it kind of like a lending library? Do you require people to come and use it there?
No, we don't lend things out. So basically what we're trying to do, as Jeff mentioned, we're trying to digitize as much as we can so that it's basically a virtual library. So obviously we live within copyright, so we have to live within those laws. But we hope that we can get our materials to students in Ireland that are studying music, Sweden, Africa, Australia, wherever. And so it's more virtual. We do have people come in and do some research, but it's more online that we're trying to get all of our collections onto.
Yeah, you're digitizing most of this stuff, but it sounds like you still have a lot of it in your possession. Museums and institutions much larger than yours have challenges adequately storing and preserving their collection. What are the ways that you address that issue? Like, how do you keep wax cylinders safe, for example?
Right, it's a challenge. So, especially we're in a historic building in Wauwatosa as well, so we kind of double down on our housing and try to get those in protective, archivally safe housing, and store them within temperature and humidity parameters to keep the artifacts safe. And we do the digitization to provide access and ability for people to actually either view or listen to this material, so we don't have to damage the rarer material by repeatedly playing it or making it physically available.
Digitization is basically the best thing you can do for preservation. So that's amazing. And we actually hired two more employees because we got a $50,000 grant from Ireland to digitize the collection. And so that money is all going towards the collections and getting everything online.
Is there a benefit to being in a town like Wauwatosa rather than, say, being in Chicago? I mean, I think a lot of people might think something like this important to the history of both countries, of the Irish here in America, would be somewhere bigger.
I think you're right as far as expectations. We're fine being right where we are. We love Wauwatosa. We're kind of entrenched in the community here with Irish Fest. In Tosa tonight, we have a Irish night there. So our roots are here. And once again, it's more virtual, more digitization that we're dealing with. It wouldn't matter, quite frankly, where you are. Quite frankly, a couple of our major collections are from Chicago because they know that we're dealing with those collections in a professional way versus giving it to another institution where it might just sit in a corner and not be dealt with.
When it comes to collecting the material, are you selective or, I mean, literally you're saying you get emails from people saying we're the greatest band in the country, download our songs. I mean, is it as simple as that or is there stuff that you just can't take?
Yeah, there are things you can't take. Like we try to be selective with our mission and collecting policies. So our mission is really to collect Irish music in America. So we have some sort of clear defined parameters. That way it will kind of give us leeway to say yes or no to any given material. And we're kind of collecting material outside of genre. So we're looking at, you know, American popular music that has roots from Irish ancestry.
Like YouTube bootlegs.
YouTube bootlegs. If you have them around, that's great. Thin Lizzy, which a lot of people don't realize, is actually an Irish band.
Yeah.
But also, you know, the traditional musicians, everyone from Michael Coleman up to Dedan and Lunasa, all the current bands.
I think one of the things that I learned in doing a lot of interviews around Irish Fest time is that so much of the music that came here with the Irish immigrants actually went back to Ireland. They had lost it there. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So in America, we were the go-to place, and Germany a little bit, with the music industry, the early music industry. Ireland was a very poor country. A lot of rural areas in Ireland didn't even get electricity until the 1950s, 1960s. And then if they got it, they would take it to the barn because the animals were the main source of their income. So there was not much of a music industry in Ireland. And so when the records were made here, then the records were sent back to Ireland in packages. And so one of the issues, Michael Coleman is probably the most prolific fiddler in history. And one of the problems, the good thing and the bad thing with Michael Coleman is that he was great and he recorded a lot of sides. But then when he sent all the records back, everybody said, now all the Irish fiddlers sound like Michael Coleman, because they were listening to his records. Yes, that is true. It's true with many areas of Irish music.
Well, we want to thank you both for stopping by and telling us a little bit about it. The community can come and visit. Is that correct?
Yep, absolutely. We're in the building Mondays through Fridays, normal hours, and if people want to make arrangements or make an appointment to come view or tour the collections, they can give us a call or drop us an email.
Jeff Kasich is the archivist for the Ward Irish Music Archives, and Barry Stapleton is its director. The archives are located on Wauwatosa Avenue, and Kasich and Stapleton joined us last month for our on-site event in East Tosa.
Since we've been talking about Irish music, we ought to listen to some. Socks in the Frying Pan first visited the Lake Effect Performance Studio in August of 2015 for their second performance year at Irish Fest.
They're from County Clare in Ireland, and the band is made up of brothers Shane and Fiacra Hayes and Aidan Coyne. The trio blends tight three-part vocal harmonies, virtuoso musical ability, and a witty stage presence, all of which Milwaukee audiences will have a chance to see Saturday evening at the Irish Cultural and Heritage Center in Wisconsin.
Here is one of the songs we recorded in the Lake Effect Performance Studio back in 2015. It's called Slip Jigs and Reels.
He was barely a man in his grandfather's coat, sewn into the lining a 10-shilling note. So goodbye to the family, goodbye to the shore. When a man tastes his fortune, you see him no more. A boat on the ocean, it's tossed like a cork. And then one fine morning, the sights in New York. So he stood on the gangplank to breathe in the air. A lowland of plenty, I've come for my share. Yes, he did like the ladies to rise and fall of their ankles and dresses down on the dance floor, rolling the dice and spin the wheel. Took most delight in the slip jigs and reels. Now some say a pistol and some say a knife, but all would agree there was somebody's wife. Some kind of commotion, a terrible fight. She left one man dead and ran into the night. A
on a train to St. Louis, just one jump ahead. He'd slept one eye open and a six gun in bed, and he dreamed of the mountains and green fields of home, crossing the plains where the buffalo roam. Yes, he did like the ladies to rise and the fall of their ankles and dresses down on the dance floor, rolling the dice and spin wheel. But he took most delight in the slip jigs and reels. Well, they called him the Kid, and by 21, sure, all that he knew was the power of a gun. And by 23, he'd shot five men down. It got in his way as he rambled around. Now a bad reputation's a hard thing to bear. Your mother's poor scorn and young children they stare. So he took consolation in fresh company. Sure, life ain't so bad with a girl on each knee. Yes, he did like the ladies to rise and fall of their ankles and dresses down on the dance floor, rolling the dice and spinning wheel. But he took most delight in the slip jigs and reels. While Miss Hilario's, I heard people say, it's the deadliest ambush near old Santa Fe. A young buck was taken, he was dressed in a coat, sewn into the lining, a 10-shilling note. Yes, he did like the ladies to rise and the fall of their ankles and dresses down on the dance floor, rolling the dice and spinning wheels. Took most delight in the slip jigs and reels.
Following that performance by Socks in the Frying Pan, we're going to take a quick break and then continue honoring St. Patrick's Day with a chat and performance by the Irish band Shaolin. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Spinning wheel, but he took most delight in the slip jigs and reels.
We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. That's the sound of the Irish band Shaolin. The five-piece group performs and writes music in English and Irish, sometimes switching languages mid-song. Their original songs, their Irish covers of pop tunes, and their high-energy stage show have catapulted them from barely being a band to headlining shows internationally.
The group made their Milwaukee Irish Fest debut last year, and they stopped by the studio then to chat with us first and give us a taste of their stage show. This is a tune that's called, in English, Buy Me Time.
Let me go. Gotta push away or watch this fire burn out. There's always something, there's always more. Gotta push away or watch this fire burn out. Oh, I find the time. Let me go. Gotta push away or watch this fire burn out. There's always something, there's always more. Gotta push away or watch this fire burn out. Gotta push away.
That's the hassle with singing bilingually. Sometimes we mix up when we're going to come in with the Irish and when we're going to come in with the English.
But it sounded great. Shaolin, thank you very much. Welcome to the studio, gentlemen. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, man. Delighted.
Yeah. And let's just go around, introduce yourselves and what you play.
It's Mr. Stefan. So I'm Stefan and I play the guitar and I sing.
It's Mr. Kevin. I do a little bit of backing singing and I play the button accordion.
I'm Colm. I play drums and percussion and this beautiful drum here.
I'm Keith. I'm Kevin's neighbour, in fact. I play mandolin and I usually play the bass guitar with the band.
Yes, Misha Dahi. I'm Dahi, and I play, well, here today I'm playing a bit of sax, but usually it's piano or keyboard and a few harmonicas or whatever else we can
right. say. Well, you talk about bilingual, and that's probably the first place we should start, because you write and sing in both Irish and English, sometimes, as we just heard, in the same song. Mm. Is that how you got together, was deciding you wanted to include Irish in music making?
I suppose the way we got together was initially was through learning the Irish language. So we met, aside from Keith and Kev, we all met each other working in Coluche de Lurgan in the west coast of Ireland in an Irish-speaking area. It's kind of like a tradition for young Irish people to go to a summer camp, an Irish language summer camp, 3 weeks during the summertime when school is off, to practice and kind of to learn Irish, because it's an exam subject, so to give a practice at it and try and get better at it. And the way they do that is by incorporating the language into everyday activities like kayaking or playing football or going off, I don't know, orienteering or hiking or whatever, and, you know, different things like that. And that's where we met. And we started doing songs together, like translating songs, pop songs from English to Irish, and making videos. And then we kind of got more into that, and we ended up working in the college doing that alone. And we did one video then, a cover of Avicii's Wake Me Up. And that one went kind of fairly viral at the time. But it was kind of a case of going from doing the odd kind of college gig in Maynooth in Kildare in Ireland up to kind of supporting Madness within a space of 3 months, which was absolute madness.
I was going to say, baptism under fire.
Oh, yeah. Completely. Like really, really.
So talk about having to like go into the cauldron and become a band. You basically just had to go and become a band.
Yeah. You should have seen our first practice. We all showed up and we were like, oh, let's make a band. This is going to work. So Kevin showed up with his accordion, and the rest of the six of us at the time showed up with acoustic guitars. Six guitars and an accordion.
Probably not one of them worked properly either as well. So
yeah. Or tuned.
Yeah, exactly. It was really a baptism of fire. But look, it put us on an absolute brilliant like journey. Like, you know, we've travelled all over the world at this stage, and we're here in Milwaukee now. This week, really, really, really excited for the Milwaukee Irish Fest, because we've heard so much about it. So we're delighted.
When I get to pick the bands that come in, I always try to get somebody who's new to the festival this year. And the song we just heard, Buy Me Time in English, what is it in Irish?
Bán an Glas. So actually, that probably starts off another point is when we're translating songs or when we're writing songs in English and in Irish, we don't always go up for an exact translation, because it wouldn't run the same way. So we use similar metaphors and similar styles to try and achieve the same goal, if you get me, with the lyrics. So Buy Me Time, we all speak English, we know what that means. But Bán an Glas literally means take off the lock. So like the lyrics are kind of about breaking away from like doing stuff you don't want to do within music and kind of doing your own kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? Whereas like in English, it's Buy Me Time, Let Me Go, Got to Push Away or Let the Fire Burn Out. So basically it's like, I need to do my own thing or else the fire is going to go, the flame is going to go. Whereas in Irish, it's like Bán an Glas, Ligam Gull, Brua Rylish, and Tinnisha Aints. It's like, let's break the lock, let's go and start the fire. So it's the same idea, but it's almost opposite.
I was going to say, different side of the journey. It's one side to the other, which actually is kind of cool when you think about it, that you're singing one in one language and you're coming at it from another angle in the other.
I suppose, because like languages do offer different insights and they offer different ways of looking at things, and there are different idioms that are used in different languages that... for us it's good. Like, it's, we have to write everything twice, I suppose, which is a bit more laborious.
And make sure it scans. It's got to fit into the musical phrase. Absolutely. You know, you've got to make that make sense.
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah. Like, that is a massive thing, yeah.
Do you start with Irish, or does it depend on the song?
Totally depends on the song for me, anyway.
It varies, I find it easier to write in English, but I have done a couple in Irish and gone the other way. And it's kind of, it completely depends on where you're at when you're kind of writing it and what the song's about, you know.
I think another part of that is that songwriting in general varies so much, like, you know, especially I think with us, a lot of the stuff we've done has been kind of project based. So like, for example, we went to Africa with a charity called Self Up Africa from Ireland, and they took us over to write a song and that we do a kind of a video over there with them. And it was, I think for them, it was about promoting what they do amongst young people. But that was a point where everyone had to chip in little musical ideas, and then bits came in, little bits of lyrics came from all over the place. And so then we were writing stuff in English and translating it into Irish, and other bits just came in Irish. Whereas then another time you might sit down and write a whole one in Irish, because for that particular project it had to be in Irish or had to be in English. So songwriting is so kind of haphazard as well, is that it really just depends on the project itself.
And with Erskine Cale as well, from what Keith was talking about, the song we wrote for South of Africa, we tried to actually translate that one to English to see how it would go. absolute disaster. Like, we just said, there's no point. We just leave it in Irish. We'll have no English alternative because everything that we were trying just was not working.
Like. I think it's the only one that we full stop. Couldn't.
Oh, yeah. I think the one didn't go very well either.
We're probably better at translating from English to Irish than from Irish to English, I think. Yeah.
Well, let's hear some music.
All right.
Absolutely.
What are you going to play for us?
This one is called Blockini, or I suppose Blocks would be the English translation of it. But the idea behind this one is just kind of, as you're growing up and how you rely on your family, it's just something that kind of came to mind when my brother had a little boy there a few years ago. So kind of you can't help but get thinking about them and just kind of how they're not afraid to fail and kind of how they lean on you, but then they just go, just gone. So that was the idea.
Kind of draws parallels to language learning as well. Like, people say children are sponges. I think like we're all sponges if we just let that wall of inhibition go and just like do it and don't worry about getting things wrong grammatically or whatever. Like, it's not a song about grammar though. It really isn't.
Three, two, three.
I've got this now. I'm trying to go, but can't figure out how you run without looking down. Just a sec, you've gone somehow. But I smile 'cause I know that you're coming back round again. You can't fool me now. Lom sawish lom achri, tasha choshi plile hulis nakri, heish lom estohiri. Oh, when you build those blocks, it's rare they don't fall to the ground. And roads they might cross, but don't ever be scared of the ones you go down. Big Achrod Pound. Shasan Ishkan Mor Ranstro. A wad nisi is kus mishani smoother law. Tasteen she boasts. Then into Lom Sao Eshlon Mahri. Tasha Khoshi Blila Ulis Lukhu. Islam is toiring. Oh, when you build those blocks, it's rare they don't fall to the ground. And roads they might cross, but don't ever be scared of the ones you go down. You'll make your own way there. You'll make your own way there. It's Big Achrod. My hand, you can let go of 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 my hand.
Blocks, what is it in Irish?
Blukini.
Blukini.
Blukini, yeah. So Blukini. Literally means blocks.
Literally means blocks. Well, that one was a direct translation. Worked, yeah. It's Shaolin in Lake Effects Performance Studio. And I'm so excited to hear the kinds of things that you're doing. It's all new music for the most part. You know, you're writing your own stuff. You're using traditional instruments, but you're also not. And all of these great, it's this great mix of things.
And it's one of the things that I think is really happening, at least from this side of the pond, that's happening in Ireland. There's so much interesting stuff happening from the most traditional, but also taking those traditional threads and doing something new with it.
Yeah,
is that fair? Do you think that's happening from your perspective?
From starting off, like, we always kind of wanted to do the whole thing of meshing old and new, if you get me. And I suppose we have three strands to what we do on stage. We have, like, our own original stuff. We have the pop songs that we translate into Irish. And then we kind of dabble with a bit of traditional stuff too, like, which we love doing, like, some traditional songs. And Kev beside me here is a traditional musician as well. So, like, as in, we exploit him a small bit every now and again. But for us, like, writing is our favourite part, writing and recording. And then, well, I suppose it's hard to actually... Writing and recording is our favourite, but so is also playing on stage, because they're kind of two obviously very different things. Stage, like, as in, it's just about energy. Energy within the kind of more intimate songs, energy within the bigger songs as well, so...
One of the really great things about getting to play stages now on the Irish circuit in America is that we're actually getting to see more of kind of Irish bands than we would even at home. Because the likes of, as you say, people who are, you know, meshing traditional with kind of more modern, contemporary and kind of folky music. The likes of Jig Jam and Wee Banjo Tree, who, you know, they play kind of folky modern songs, and then they'll just explode into a big traditional Irish set. And then they'll just wrap it right back in again, and
the old bluegrass going there.
Bluegrass as well, like, and each one of those bands kind of, you know, does something very particular and very different as well, and that's something that I think is really exciting coming out of Ireland at the moment.
It's that multifaceted part of it, because I think a lot of people who are not into the scene think jigs and reels. That's all that, you know, and that's great.
Yeah.
Those things are wonderful, mm-hmm. but there's so much more.
Absolutely. There is. Yeah.
I think it kind of comes naturally from no more than. Our love for the Irish language, which we kind of grew over time, it's kind of reflected in the music insofar as we look at Irish as a modern language that's grown. It's a living language, so it's constantly changing. There's new words coming in. We're trying to instill that love in kids and teenagers, especially back home. And that's kind of through the music that we do, kind of, as Stefan said, one of the facets of the things that we do would be kind of pop songs. But not only are we changing the words to Irish or Ascaiga, but we're adding in our own kind of slant on it. So as you say, you have an accordion in playing the main riff, and then randomly a saxophone thrown in for good measure.
Before I get to the last tune, I want to go back to the language again, because we kind of started there. Do you consider yourselves completely bilingual?
Yeah, I would say bilingual, yeah.
At this point?
Well, trilingual now. There's a bit of African going on there with the Luganda, you know. completely bilingual, I would say. Like, as in, going ahead, we used to kind of battle with how are we going to work songs? Are we going to do, like, half-half? And we've done a few half-half songs. But I think for the next few releases, we're going to do a double release kind of thing, where we have an Irish version and an English version. Just gets kind of cleaner, I think we feel. So that's what we're going to try in the next release and see how that goes.
What are you thinking? What are you dreaming?
What are we dreaming of?
Dreaming in. What are you dreaming in Irish or dreaming in English?
Oh, sorry.
If you go over and work in the West, like, because we go over every summer and you spend a few weeks or a few months even working over there, but for sure you'd start dreaming in Irish then, you know? But then you come home and you mightn't be speaking Irish as much, and you might go back to English or whatever.
That's what the director of that summer camp actually said to me the first year. He goes, if you're dreaming in Irish, you know you're doing something right.
I suppose for me anyway, it depends on, like, literally the last conversation almost. If we're speaking Irish together, you'd start thinking in Irish then.
Exactly, yeah. When I spend too much time with these feckers here, I end up thinking in Irish, and you'd be walking down the road, and then you might even actually say the first few words in Irish, and then pull back, and then back to English.
Yeah.
The best thing is I love the differences in kind of even the English that we speak in Ireland and the English that we speak in America, you know. Like, I remember being over in New York and walking up, like, my dad's a police officer or a guard, you know, back home. And I walked up to the police officer and I was like, oh, geez, I'll talk to this fella now because, like, my dad's a guard as well, you know. And I was like, well, any crack? And he was like, what did you say? I was like, any crack? Oh, right, I get it now, yeah. crack's obviously something else.
Yes.
But, like, at home, it just means... that's how we greet, like, isn't it? It's a bit fun, you know.
What's the story? What's the
good crack.
Crack, C-R-A-I-C, is an Irish language word which has slipped into Anglo-Irish or Irish English. So we'd use it the whole time, but it gets you in trouble over here, right, because it's a different meaning.
Yes, it's not a good thing.
Yes.
And it's an illegal thing here. Yes. It's a combination of bad and illegal. Yeah, you don't want to be talking.
Especially talking to police officers.
No.
Right? You
don't want But they all know here in Milwaukee during this week of Irish Fest that they're going to hear a lot of crack. And they get it.
What kind of a festival is this?
That's why everyone's so happy. Yeah. Well, gentlemen, it has been such a pleasure to have you in the studio. What are you going to take us out with?
We're going to give you the African one, Erskine Caelan. Keep an ear out for the bit in Uganda as well.
All right.
Oh, and we want to say a big shout out to all the Milwaukee Irish Fest social media team who we've been over and back with having a bit of crack with on social media the last while. So we'll dedicate the first song, Buy Me Time, to them. And this one is Erskine Caelan.
That is the Irish band Shaolin, recorded in the Lake Effect Performance Studio last August ahead of their Irish Fest debut. They'll follow it up with another appearance this year. Our studio session was engineered by Jason Reavy, and you can hear all three songs they played for us at WUWM.com. That is all for this edition of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now. All Things Considered is coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.